it's applicable to everything. You know, like, just because you don't know how to do something, it just means you haven't learned it yet. That's all it is. And it's not some innate knock on yourself. Like, you know, Elon Musk wasn't born with the ability to start a company and, you know, create superconductors and make electric cars. Like, he learned, he went through the process. He started one company and then he started another, and then he grew and then he got bigger, and then he gained these skills and this knowledge to do these things.
Life is busy. Schedules are full. Money is tough. Marriage is tough. Kids, family, friends, work, housework. Ew. There is so much on our plate these days, and I think it's time we start taking stuff off. The Unstuffed podcast is a minimalist lifestyle and mindset podcast created to help you feel a little less overwhelmed and is designed to help give you the permission to eliminate any of life's clutter that's not working for you. You only get one life after all, and it's so much bigger than all this other stuff. So sit back, take a walk. It's your turn to take a break, and I will take over from here. Welcome to the Unstuffed podcast.
Hey there, it's me, Renee. Welcome back to the Unstuffed podcast. For those of you who are parents, I want you to take a second to think about what you would do if a doctor sat you down and told you that your child was eventually going to lose their sight. I know my first instinct would be shock, grief, depression, and this deep desire to show them this world before they could potentially never see it again. We take so much of our sight for granted. And this conversation really brought that to light for me in a whole new way. If you are a parent, this is an episode you're going to want to tune into. This is not only heart-wrenching conversation, but a really uplifting reminder to control what we can, to take steps toward being better every day, and to fully embrace and enjoy every single part of this life that we can. I sat down with physician, nonprofit founder, and dad, Stephen Johnston, to talk about what he did when his son was given this diagnosis and how he and his family are working to turn it into something amazing.
Hi, Stephen.
Hi there, and thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm so excited to be able to chat with you today, because you've got a really heartfelt story that I think a lot of parents out there can maybe relate to in some ways. Do you want to kind of dive in and share a little bit about your journey and how you've gotten to where you are right now?
Sure. Well, there's so many ways I could take that. So I'll start fairly simply and then we can let it grow from there. The short version is, so my name is Steve Johnston. I am a dad of two kids in Gilbert, Arizona. And my son was born with a rare genetic condition called Bardet-Biedl syndrome. And he has within that a condition called retinitis pigmentosa, which is causing him to slowly lose his vision. And upon getting that diagnosis, we decided to take action as a family and form our nonprofit, A Race Against Blindness, to help support awareness and a cure for his condition and the thousands of other kids like him who are also losing their vision.
Oh, that's so huge. And I guess I would just ask, as a parent, how did it feel to get some news like that?
Yeah, it's never easy, of course. You can't prepare yourself for getting news like that. You never really believe it can be you. I work in the medical field. I'm a physician. You'd think that I would be as prepared as anybody to get tough news like that. And you never are. So it doesn't matter who you are, what your background is, you're never ready to get tough news about your child like that. So that was it tossed my world upside down and around. And then again, a few more times before I really was able to process it and move forward. So it was a really hard, really hard time to get that diagnosis.
Oh my gosh. I would imagine we had a brief period of time where our son fell really ill. And I just know there's nothing, I don't think I've ever experienced anything more devastating, just because you want to do everything you can to just give that child the best, healthiest possible life. Now, I'm sure there was a period of downtime. I think a lot of times people hear stories like yours, that you've turned this into a nonprofit and done something good from it, I think we can so quickly think like you just immediately like brush off your shoulders and started to do all the good stuff. How did this process kind of unfold? You know, there had to have been like a grieving period, I would imagine, before you kind of stood up and decided to do something impactful with it.
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned the grieving period. That's exactly what it was. When you get a diagnosis like this, there is that grieving period where you go through like the sadness and the depression, denial, like this isn't happening to me, this isn't real. And then you start to process it and you kind of accept that it's happening and it's real. And that was a long process. I mean, there was a, you know, a good long amount of time from the time we got the diagnosis to the time that we decided to take action, which was kind of the final step in our grieving process, which is taking control of the situation to the best of our ability and doing something about it. And, you know, he got diagnosed, you know, a couple of years ago now, and we only started the nonprofit a year ago. So, I mean, we really went through a long amount of time of, you know, accepting it and, you know, going through that process and learning how to deal with it. And until we got to the point of really taking action. So that's a very, you know, if anybody else is going through anything, whether it's, you know, getting a tough diagnosis or a hard loss in the family, you have to go through that process. And it's not something that happens overnight. And it's going to take a different amount of time for everybody, regardless of their situation. And so you just have to allow yourself the time and grace to go through those moments. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you as a physician, maybe this is a grand assumption, but I'm definitely this kind of person. I'm a pick up, take charge, get through things. And, you know, did you kind of have that feeling like you really wanted to control or do something when you first get this? I know when our son spent a period in the hospital, and it was just like I was in constant go mode of learning everything I could about this, learning all the steps that I needed to take, everything I needed to do next. And then you kind of hit this point where you kind of burn out and crash. I'm just curious if you experienced anything kind of similar to that.
Yeah, no, you're 100% right. As a parent, one of the worst feelings ever is feeling helpless and hopeless, that you can't help your child and that there's no hope for, you know, a future in something like that, this diagnosis. So that's obviously a very hard thing to receive as a parent. And then compound that with my medical background and really my urge is to, how can we treat this? How can we fix this? How can we do something about it? And then as a man, you know, wanting to be able to lead and do something about it and protect and do all those things. So like I'm sitting there getting, you know, assaulted on all my core fronts of everything that makes me who I am. And, you know, how do you deal with all that? And ultimately the one thing that, you know, was the one fix to all that is just taking action and doing something about it. And that can look different, right? You know, it doesn't have to be like I'm going to go fix this and cure it. It can just be I'm taking control of what I can take control of, which is I'm going to, in your case, I'm going to become more knowledgeable about it. I'm going to learn about it so that I can treat him to the best of my ability within the limits that are available. I'm going to go raise awareness so other people can, you know, learn about this and maybe they don't have to go through it the same way, or I can be a resource to other people who are going through the same thing. Like there's lots of ways taking action can look. In my case, that was a lot of it, was those aspects of, you know, the taking action, but also I was lucky in the sense that once I decided to take action that we were able to connect with some researchers doing some really high-end amazing research on my son's condition. And that we were able to kind of attach our nonprofit to their mission as well and feel like we're really working towards a cure and that we're supporting something big, which is what we've luckily been able to start to do.
That's so amazing. And my first thought when you even tell your story is, how the heck did you have the resources or the knowledge to start a nonprofit? That just sounds like something that's definitely out of my area of expertise. You know, how did you kind of get that idea? What did you do? How did you even start it?
So, yeah, I mean, I have no experience running a nonprofit. I'm a physician and I also happen to have a business background. I got my MBA during my medical school years. So I had kind of the business knowledge and some experience working in the non-medical setting. But ultimately, it really was just a matter of just, you know, learning a lot of research. You know, there's so many amazing resources out there nowadays. If you want to go find them, whether it's, you know, YouTube videos or articles or, you know, other people who are doing things like this. There's so many resources out there to help you accomplish whatever it is you're trying to accomplish. So the amount of free information is amazing, and it can be such a huge resource. And so I really relied on a lot of that to look at the logistics of, like, what does it take to run a nonprofit? What does that look like? What are the things that need to happen? And there are services that can help with, like, the paperwork side and the legal side to make sure you're in compliance and doing all the things that the government wants. And ultimately, at the end of the day, there's a lot of trial and error. Like, you just have to, once you get past the legal side and the logistics, you know, how do I raise money? How do I raise awareness? Like, what things work, what things don't? And you just have to be willing to fail. You know, you have to be willing to have setbacks and learn from them and grow and not give up, because whether you're starting a business and you're going to sell t-shirts, or you're going to, you know, invent, you know, electric cars, or you're going to try to, you know, raise awareness and funds for a rare disease, you're going to have hurdles and challenges, and you just have to be willing to take those and grow from them and keep pushing forward.
You're so right. That's something I've been thinking on so much lately. I just have so many examples of, you know, people who will say things to me, or examples in my life of people who seek that perfection. They want to be perfect before they take action. So I love that you guys kind of just found a way to take that messy action towards something that you were really feeling passionate about.
Yeah.
What have you done to raise awareness? Like, how have you taken this nonprofit and made people more knowledgeable about all of this?
Yeah. So once we started the nonprofit, we really didn't know what we were going to be able to accomplish or the things we'd be able to do. And shortly after starting the nonprofit and trying to connect with the medical research community and seeing, is there anybody working on this disease and condition that we can support? And, well, you know, we kept getting a lot of no's and a lot of, like, well, we're kind of working on something similar, but not this disease. And so there was a lot of, like, learning to try to find the right people to support. And ultimately, we got connected with a research group that's based in the UK, and they were working on my son's exact condition, luckily. And so we came along at the right time, in the sense that they had this therapy that they had been working on for a number of years, and it was ready to go to a human clinical trial. And they were like, hey, this is the one thing that we're missing is money. We don't have the funds to do this yet. And we were like, great, that's what we want to do, is we want to raise awareness and funds for, you know, his condition and his disease. And so our missions kind of aligned, and we really put all of our efforts into, now that we have this target, this therapy that could cure his condition, how do we make this a reality? So we really pushed hard on the fundraising front of, what are the ways we can raise money as a nonprofit? And we tried lots of different things, you know, to trial and error, like, you know, from holding a bake sale on up to trying to do, you know, a big national campaign. And we have done it all and tried it all. And I'm personally a big believer that, you know, every dollar counts and every dollar makes a difference. And I've been really so focused on the awareness side of just getting this in front of as many people as possible, because, you know, let's say we need $10 million. You know, we could go get $10 million from one person, and that would be great. And, you know, that would be wonderful to, you know, find some, you know, billionaire that wants to, you know, give $10 million to a rare condition, but the likelihood of that is very low. Conversely, if we got in front of 10 million people who all threw in $1, that's $10 million. And so I really have, you know, made a huge concerted effort to make people feel like their vote and their dollar counts, and that they can make a difference with any amount of resources that they have available to them. So even if all you can do is throw in a dollar and share it to your friends and tell your friends about it, that is, you're making such an amazing impact. Because if you did that, you share it with 10 friends, and then they share it with 10 friends, and then they share it with 10 friends, and the next thing you know, like, we've come to this cure for this rare disease. And so that, you know, I believe that every single person can make a difference in these type of causes.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's such a great reminder for everybody, because oftentimes I think we feel like if we can't give 100 or if we can't give 20, don't bother. What, you know, and yep. You just kind of feel bad. I know I do. If yep. You see something you want to give to and you're like, oh, shoot, I can't right now. I don't have even 20, or, you know, but yeah, even considering a single dollar or a quick share has such a huge impact. That's how things go viral. That's how messages spread.
That's right. And it really does. And I, you know, one of the examples I've used is, I love music. I love live concerts, you know, being in front of that crowd, the energy, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, when the concert starts and, you know, it's just noise, you know, people are yelling and screaming and the music's on, you can't hear the person next to you. You can't even tell what they're saying. You're trying to yell to hear them. You know, we've all experienced that big crowd phenomenon. But then there's that moment in the concert where like that song that everybody knows comes on. It's like the hit song, the pop song or whatever. And like everybody's singing it and like the band stops playing, but like the crowd is still singing it and it's crystal clear and it's coming through loud and clear. And so it's a great analogy that because if you take those 10,000 people who were 10 minutes ago screaming and yelling and you couldn't hear the person next to you, now you've got 10,000 people all going towards the same cause, the same effort, doing the same thing, and it's crystal clear and it's this overwhelming response. And if the same thing happened with a cause like this, if 10,000 people all just got together and made their voice heard by working together on that one thing, it's amazing the impact that it can have. So it's really just an amazing reminder that your vote can count, your voice can count, your dollar can count. And I know that's so easy to feel like it's not true these days with the way politics works and the world works. It's very easy to feel like that nothing matters. There's no way I can help. So, and it's just not true.
Right. And I love that analogy, but I also love that, you know, I do. There's a lot of things in our world right now that can feel out of our control, but it's kind of nice to have that reminder that in some of these areas, like you said, controlling what you can when you heard about this diagnosis, when we come across things like this, or when we hear people who are needing help or wanting to grow their research, to just do a small thing, you can control that little tiny bit of something. That's so powerful.
Yeah, no, one of the mental models that I love Navy SEALs because they're so mentally strong and they can achieve such unworldly tasks, it seems. And one of the simple things that they talk about is staying in your 3-foot world, meaning what is in your immediate sphere of influence right around you, because you can't control what somebody down the street is going to do, whether they're going to, you know, blow up a building or do whatever, but like what's right in front of me, like what can I control right here, right now? I'm going to take one step forward. I am going to open this door. I am going to make this phone call. I am going to make this post about, you know, this thing. I am going to do whatever I can in my immediate sphere of control. And I can't control all the bigger things around me taking place. And I think when you realize that and you just focus on what is directly around you and what you can touch, feel, and control, it really empowers you to take control of hard situations and segment down big, overwhelming tasks to, you know, something that's achievable and doable. Because once you believe in it and once you realize that, like, yes, I can make an impact on this, like, am I going to be able to solve this tomorrow? No, but like, I can do this. I can take this step and then that step will lead to that step. And then next thing you know, I'm going to be at this, you know, really far place down the road that's very successful that I won't even believe would have been possible a year ago. But you have to take those little baby steps in your immediate sphere of control.
Yeah, I love that. And I feel like I recently heard a similar message, but I didn't know that the Navy SEALs kind of had that mentality. I have to tell my husband because he loves the Navy SEALs too. Yeah. They're just an impressive group. So
it is.
But my question leads me into the thing I was wondering was, you know, did getting this diagnosis kind of shift your mindset to be a little bit more, you know, focused on just what's in front of you? Or have you always kind of been in that mentality?
No, I would say definitely, you know, whether I had that mentality in some way or shape or form before is up for debate. But I really know that getting this diagnosis and having to learn how to process something so big and overwhelming to me was definitely the learning curve of, you know, okay, like I've got to, you know, simplify this out. I got to segment this out. What can I control? What can I do? Because, you know, if you start to think about all the things you can't control, you know, it becomes overwhelming and it will just weigh you down and completely stop you in your tracks. And then that will make you feel like you can't make a difference. And then, you know, now you're out of control of the situation and it's a horrible, horrible feeling to be in. So I really had to adopt that and learn it and develop it. It's, you know, it's not a innate skill set that I think most people are born with. You know, these things are learned and developed over time. And just like the Navy SEALs, they train, they are taught, they go through, you know, rigorous training to get to that level. And, you know, the same is true for any of us undergoing any of our endeavors. We have to train, we have to practice, we have to learn, we have to go through these things. So if you feel like you're not in a place that you want to be and able to take on the challenges, like it's just because you haven't put in that, you know, you haven't gone through that skill set training yet. And you can, though. You can, whatever it is that you're going to take on, whether it's I'm going to learn a new skill and get a new job, or I'm going to go to school for a new thing, or I'm going to start a nonprofit, like, you just have to put in the time and effort to learn those things, and you can achieve amazing things if you decide to and put your mind to it.
I love that you say we haven't gone through training for that yet. That's such a great way to put it, because I feel like sometimes I just help my daughter sign up for high school classes, which is crazy. But you know, some classes she has to take, you know, some things you just kind of fall into and you've got to figure it out. But other things, yeah, it's an elective. I need to get better in this area. I'm going to work at this.
Absolutely.
I love that concept of training for just improving ourselves as a human being, I suppose.
Of course. I mean, it's applicable to everything, you know, like, just because you don't know how to do something, it just means you haven't learned it yet. That's all it is. And it's not some innate knock on yourself. Like, you know, Elon Musk wasn't born with the ability to start a company and, you know, create superconductors and make electric cars. Like, he learned, he went through the process. He started one company and then he started another, and then he grew and then he got bigger, and then he gained these skills and this knowledge to do these things. Like, so I think that, you know, you just have to realize, like, all these people who do these amazing things, it wasn't like they woke up and they had it. Michael Jordan, he got cut from his high school basketball team, and then he practiced, and then he learned, and then he got better, and then he grew. You know, like, it's a repeatable story over and over and over again, that everybody who achieves these big things, it's, they had these hardships and these challenges, and they learned, and then they grew, and then they got the skills, and then they you know, got to this point. So it's easy to look at somebody who's there and think that they're just there, but like, everybody went through that process of learning and training and growing to get there.
Right. And I 100% think that mentality of the 3 feet, you know, that can help you achieve so much more when you're just not getting distracted by all of the other potential things. And you're just kind of focused on that,
yeah,
that goal or that where you want to go.
Yeah. Another favorite saying is how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. You know, I mean, it's so true. Like, no, you're not going to devour it in one shot. Like, you have to just start one bite at a time, one little thing at a time. Like, that is the only way you're going to achieve these seemingly overwhelming, huge tasks.
Yeah. Those are messages I love, because I was born as the person who was like, I need to eat the whole thing. It has to be done, and it has to be done now. So it's been such a impactful lesson to have to work to learn to improve in that area of my life, of just the small steps at a time.
Yeah. And it's hard, right? You know, like, instant gratification is fun and it feels good and all those kind of things, but all these big hard tasks, starting a nonprofit, you know, fundraising for a cure, getting to the point of being able to do all this stuff, it's a long game. It's not, you know, this is not something that's accomplished today, tomorrow, next month. Like, you have to put in the time, the work, the effort to achieve those things, and realize that, like, this is, again, a process. It's one bite at a time, one step at a time. So you can't get overwhelmed by the enormity of the bigger goals. And you really have to focus on that 3 foot world and what's immediately something you can take control of.
Yeah. Now, as a parent, I can't help but feel like I would respond getting the news that my son was going to potentially or slowly lose his eyesight. Did you feel that obligation to, like, let's go see the world, let's go see the ocean, let's go see, like, show him all of the things?
Yep.
Is that something that you kind of went through?
Yeah, it sure was. If I could bottle up that feeling and sell it to people or give it to people or whatever, it would be the greatest gift I could give to anyone, is that feeling like, you know, it's time to go. It's time to see the world. It's time to appreciate life. It's time to live life to the fullest, because you know, in that moment where you're like, he's only got this much time left potentially to see all these things, it's like, we got to go and we got to do all this. And so, you know, like, last summer we went on a full summer trip, all of us, to go tour around the Pacific Northwest and see national parks and go do as much as we could in that little amount of time to, you know, give him experiences, on summer break. And so it was, you know, it's one of those things that you do try to just appreciate life and live life to the fullest while you have the chance, because tomorrow is not guaranteed, whether it's being alive, having your health or your vision or any of the things. Like, you know, you really, life is to be lived right now. So I would definitely give that feeling to somebody, so that they could feel that urge to go experience things and do all the things they've been waiting on.
So I totally agree. The Pacific Northwest is one of my obsessions. I'm like, I don't know why I live in the Midwest, because it's so beautiful out there. And I'm someone who, I think I had, my dad died when I was 19. So I started to have that feeling, that YOLO. But I think as a 19-year-old, for me, that was like, buy all of the things. And that's something I talk heavily on, is I just shopped and spent, and that was living. Do you feel like having him get this diagnosis kind of shifted that focus for you in any way? Because I know I've had to go through times in my life where I took my focus from being like, living means like partying or having fun or constantly, you know, giving into those impulses, like you said, getting those dopamine hits and instant gratification, versus really like fully immersing yourself in the richness of an experience or of life.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, like you said, you know, what you were going through was a horrible, hard thing for any teenager or any human to go through. And, you know, there's a predictable series of things that you might try to do to cope with it. And like you said, those little hits of dopamine to try to make yourself feel better and like get through that, it's very predictable and very understandable. And I think most people have to have gone through that at some level or in their life to understand that that's a way to handle things, but it maybe is not the best way. It's not the healthiest way. It doesn't fulfill you as much. And so when you've had those moments and you've learned from them, again, training experience, like all going back to these themes, like you've been through it. Now you appreciate some of the more important things in life, the really fulfilling things. And certainly for us, that was, you know, I was already at the point in my life where I had experienced some things like that for you, you know, like where you learn, like, these things don't matter. These things don't fulfill us. These things don't, it really doesn't matter at the end of the day. So like what matters is your experiences, you know, the company that you have around you, the places you've been and got to experience. It's just such a impactful, you know, way to live. And then again, it's not for everybody. So like, if you don't get fulfilled by, you know, seeing beautiful sights and going those things, like that's totally fine. Like, but whatever it is that, you know, lights your fire and makes you feel fulfilled, that's how you should really, you know, focus your daily life. Because, you know, putting your time and effort into things that ultimately don't matter is one of the worst feelings at the end of the day. And so really appreciating life and living it to the fullest is super important. And for us, that was certainly experiences and quality time.
So when you say we, was it you have your whole family kind of took this trip out west?
Yeah. So, it was a pretty wild thing on the surface, if you look at it. So my kid's mom and I are not married. We've been divorced for about 5 years. And we, you know, after getting this diagnosis, we really came together in terms of, you know, doing what needed to be done for the kids and all that kind of stuff. We were already very good co-parents, luckily, and we had a good co-parenting relationship. But this kind of went to the next level of really doing whatever was needed for them to support them. And so when we decided that we really wanted to give the kids experiences, we were like, well, how are we going to do this? You know, like, what can we do? And what ended up happening was we took this big, huge family trip where it was me, her, the kids, her friend that she sees, he came along, you know, parents came along, her parents were there for most of the trip. My parents came along at various points in the trip. So it was really just this giant family event that was kind of put together of like, these are the things that matter, like giving the kids the experiences, seeing these places, letting us enrich them with these special opportunities, and letting my son see the world and all that kind of stuff. That's what matters. It doesn't matter, like, you know, this, it doesn't matter that, all these other peripheral things don't matter. We're putting all that stuff completely aside, and we're just focusing on this one really important thing that matters. And so, yeah, we all travel together. We all hopped in vans and traveled around and went from national park and site to site and place to place, and just kind of all experienced it together.
That gives me a little goosebumps everywhere. That sounds so amazing. I grew up in very blended families, you know, where I tell people I have sisters, but they are actually my ex stepsisters, but they're still my sister. You know, like, I'm just a very family oriented person, and our immediate family is very similar. So I know how important and amazing that must have been for your kids to have this big union. That's so wonderful that you guys were all able to do that for them and for yourselves and for your son. I love that.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I mean, it was a special it was a special trip, and I hope it can be a good, reminder for people in, tough situations with families and co-parenting and all those kind of things. It's like, regardless of what you have going on, try to take those opportunities to put the things that really matter most in front of you. Try to really put aside some of the things that may not matter so much, and do the best you can for your kids. Every situation is obviously different. I'm not going to try to say every co-parenting relationship is one where you want to do that. There's obviously a lot of reasons why that could not make sense for some people. But generally speaking, I just hope it's an example for some people who might be in a similar situation.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. So how have your kids, have they had a really big look or impact, or how do they kind of fit into the nonprofit? Do they have a part of it at all?
Yeah, to some degree, we do include them in some of the videos and the storytelling of who we are as a family. But we've also really made a big effort to try to insulate them from that thing that we're doing so that they can have a normal childhood and a normal life and experience normal kid things without feeling that this thing is I wake up all day and I spend all day doing this. This is my entire life. I don't want it to be theirs. I don't want them to have to live that necessarily. I want them to be normal kids and do normal kid things and experience the world. And they know what we're doing, and we teach them about it and tell them, and we include them in it at an appropriate level so that they are aware of what this all is and what we're doing. But we've really tried to make sure that it's not their entire life.
That makes so much sense. And I love that you're doing that. I talk a lot about minimalism on my podcast and things, and how I've decluttered and simplified my space, but I don't make my kids do it because that was my journey. That's what I wanted to do, and it's not for them. But I also would imagine for your son. So I was born with a cataract in my left eye. I had my actual lens removed from my eye. And I just remember my mom, bless her heart, if I missed a ball, if someone threw a softball at me, she'd be like, "Oh, it's because of her eye. It's because she's disabled." And I just remember being like, "It's not that big of a deal. Give me some credit." But I think a lot of times parents, well-meaning, just love on their kids so much that they can kind of overemphasize the difference when they've got something going on. Do you kind of feel like you actively try not to focus too much on that?
Yeah, I do. The way I see it, this is something he has. It's not who he is. We all have things, right? Whether it's, I have, some mental quirks and, personality quirks, or something bigger. Somebody has a true physical disability that they overcome, or an illness that they have. Those are things that make them who they are, but it is not who they are. Unless they define themselves that way, and that's their self-definition of who they are, and that's, they can choose to do that. That is totally appropriate. But as a parent, in terms of how I'm, raising him, I'm, he obviously has this. This is something he will have to deal with and learn how to manage and, get through. But it is not who he is. He's a totally amazing, bright, smart, funny, warm, gentle kid who has all these hobbies and things he likes to do. And that's who he is, right? It's the combination of all those things that make him who he is. And his vision loss is just part of that. So trying to let him be a full, entire person within that context is really important.
Has he had to pivot or shift any of those hobbies that he likes doing? Have they kind of changed?
Yeah, so he's kind of early in his vision loss path right now. So one of the first vision loss things that you experience with his condition is actually issues with night vision. So it becomes very hard to see in low light situations or in the dark. And we've noticed that certainly to a pretty high degree, where he's pretty uncomfortable at night, where he'll really grab onto us to safely navigate, or he's unsure of his environment. Or he can't physically see things that are right in front of him sometimes, his stuffed animal in bed, he can't find his stuffed animal. So there's been a lot of those type of things, but that hasn't translated as much into daytime activities, school activities and things like that. Yet he's having some kind of issues with some of that, that we've had to make accommodations for to make sure he's, safe and all that, but he's still pretty active in terms of his normal routines and stuff right now. And we'll keep kind of evolving that over time as his, disease changes. And, but yeah, it's, it affects things. There's no way around it. You can't pretend that it's not real. And, you do have to, change the way you do certain things. And But it's not, it's just the same way you would do with any other impairment or illness or whatever. You would just kind of accommodate to those things, make some of the changes necessary, and then you keep living life.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's great to hear, you know, that that's how it's going. And I don't know if you mentioned, what was it called that his disease called?
Yeah. So he has, his underlying genetic condition is called Bardet-Biedl syndrome. And the eye condition he has is essentially called retinitis pigmentosa, which the name retinitis pigmentosa is a group of diseases all caused by different underlying genetic causes. So retinitis pigmentosa is a vision loss pattern that thing can be caused by Bardet-Biedl syndrome or Leber congenital amaurosis or all these other genetic causes. So it's his cause is Bardet-Biedl syndrome.
Okay. Were these things that you were familiar with already or no? Okay.
No, not at all. I mean, so retinitis pigmentosa is considered a rare disease by medical definition. Bardet-Biedl syndrome is considered an ultra rare disease by medical definitions. So he has an ultra rare disease. So in the US, there's probably 3,000, 5,000 people that have his condition. So it's a really small number. There's, you know, some high schools that have more people than that in it. So, you know, it's just a really rare, small disease that he has. But retinitis pigmentosa certainly affects people on the order of hundreds of thousands of people, but it's still a rare disease. When you look at the size of, you know, the world's population and all that kind of stuff. So we're advocating for rare and ultra rare diseases. It's that presents challenges.
I'm sure. Do you feel like, you know, it's tough to have people understand if they're not experiencing or do they don't know someone who's personally experiencing it?
Yeah, that's definitely one of the hurdles, right? Is like a lot of the causes that people get very passionate about are things that they can develop some type of personal connection to and that they can understand. And I get it, because unless you can understand what it's like for that person and to feel that and to understand what they're going through, then it's very hard to get motivated and passionate about it. Like, so that's why cancer is obviously a very moving cause that so many people can get behind, is because so many people know somebody that's been affected by cancer, whether it's a family member, a friend, themselves, et cetera. Like, it's as a diagnosis, cancer is a very large, you know, set of diagnoses. And then there are a million sub causes of cancer, obviously, whether it's breast cancer, prostate cancer, you know, lymphoma, you know, there's all these different, you know, causes of cancer that then people get into their sub causes. But generally speaking, if like you say, I'm supporting cancer research, people are going to be like, okay, like, let's do that, you know, like that. So that's something that's more relatable to the masses versus something like this, where it's like, hey, my son's losing his vision. And they're like, wow, I didn't even know that's possible. Like, I mean, that's a very common reaction, is like, I didn't know that was a thing. I thought you were just either blind or you weren't, you know, like, and that's a very reasonable reaction, because it's not talked about in the general population. There's not a lot of public figures who, you know, you've heard about that, you know, are blind. There's not a lot of blind, you know, celebrities. You know, you hear about the rare stories like the Ray Charles of the world and things like that, where there's like some really big, you know, celebrity that, you know, has had this, but there's, you know, it's usually those rare cases. And even then, you don't know how that happened or what the underlying cause is. And like, was he born with it, or did he develop it or whatever? So it's just a rare, you know, disease. And so that, you know, there's a lot of education and teaching that goes along with telling people about it and letting them learn about it and letting them see the impact it has on people.
Yeah. I think as a parent, I think a lot of us could, you know, imagine what that would feel like, but you're right. It's gotta be a difficult one. It's not a very commonly heard thing.
Nope.
How's the research looking then? If you, as you said, you had a tough time finding people who were doing it.
Yeah. So we got lucky when we found that research group in the UK who was kind of working on this, and our stars aligned that we were kind of looking to do the same thing that they were. So their therapy they had been working on for a number of years was past, you know, the basic science, past the animal models, and ready to go to a human clinical trial. And when we came along was when they were at that point of, hey, we want to do this human clinical trial, but the one thing that's lacking is funding. We don't have the money to do it yet. And so that's really became our mission to do the fundraising. So that's where we still stand, is that we are fundraising for this real therapy that once we have the money can go to a human clinical trial and start saving the vision of thousands of kids who have this condition. So it's really exciting that we have this thing at our fingertips and it's so close to us and it's so there, but it's also really hard in the sense of you're sitting there going like, money is the one thing that's preventing saving my son's eyesight and all these kids' eyesight. It's like, it's just money. And then you go down these rabbit holes and you're like, you see the news, like, you know, the Senate passes a $95 billion aid package for this, that, or the other. And you're like, but we need $10 million, $10 million, and we can save thousands of kids' eyesight, you know? And so that's when it gets like hard and frustrating and demoralizing. And you just have to keep one foot in front of the other, 3 foot world. What can I control? How can I handle this? So you just keep fighting forward, but we're right there. Like, people can make an immediate impact on saving kids' eyesight and making this trial a reality. So it's that's the upside and that's the positive side that we're focused on.
So if anyone is listening to this and just feels it on their heart to give $1, $5, $20, $100, where can they find where can they donate?
So we have a website. We are a 501c3 nonprofit, which means we are a tax deductible, you know, donation that you can make. And our website is araceagainstblindness.org. Our nonprofit's name is Erase Against Blindness. So if you Google us or just type that into a browser, you'll find us. It'll pop right up. And on the website, there's just like a donate button that you can click and choose to donate however much you are able to. And like I said, if you're not able to donate anything, like a great no cost way you can make an impact is literally just go on Instagram or wherever and, you know, share our story, you know, send it to your friends, tell people about it. You know, amplifying the message is a hugely important step for us in terms of getting the word out there and letting people know. The more people that know about it, the more people that can support it and make a difference. And if people don't know, they can't help. And that is the simple reality. And you can make a huge impact on spreading that message. So even if you can't give a dollar, just, you know, go on there and give us a share, and that would mean the world to us.
Oh, that's amazing. And we'll be sure to link to that in the show notes, so it's easier if you guys just want to scroll and click.
Cool.
Thank you so much for popping on and sharing. And I wish you all the best of luck. I hope that you guys can reach that number. Is there a certain time frame that you're, you know, is there a goal you're hoping for to be able to raise that $10 million?
So we're trying to get it done as soon as we can, obviously. You know, time is of the essence. The reason we chose our name, A Race Against Blindness, is because we are racing against time. We are racing against blindness. So time is of the essence, and we have this amazing opportunity to, you know, potentially cure this disease while my son still has, you know, good preserved vision. And so we're really trying to do it as fast as we can. You know, whatever that timeline is, we don't know what that will ultimately be. But yeah, our goal is to try to get there this year. We're doing multiple different aspects of fundraising and helping raise money for the trial. So we're going to get there.
Oh, good. Well, I'm so glad that we got to chat and got to share this message. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me and giving me the opportunity to talk about this. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Hey again, thanks so much for hanging out with me today on the Unstuffed podcast. It means so much that you chose to carve out some of your precious time just to hang out with me. If you aren't quite ready for our time to end, head to the show notes where you can grab my free declutter checklist, join my newsletter subscription, and connect with me on some of your favorite social platforms. Sending you so much love. Until next time.